It's Wednesday, August 1st, 2007, and you're listening to episode 63 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Adam.
My name is Luke.
And my name is Tex.
Okay, and as you guys have noticed, Tex has now joined us as well. With the exit of two of our hosts, we have replaced them with two new people. Luke is, well, I don't know, I hate to start matching up who's replacing whom, just because every human being is unique, so it's hard to replace one person with another. But nonetheless, Luke and Tex are now our two new hosts, and everybody should, by this point, if you've been following the show, know who Tex is. He is, of course, my brother, and also on top of that, he has joined us for a few episodes in the past. But before we dig into this episode, I have to clear his name because I said something unintentionally ambiguous in episode 62 that made him look rather crooked. And by virtue of doing that, made the show look rather crooked. And so I need to explain this. In episode 62, and I actually copied down the exact quote today while I was at work, which is, you know, what work is for, because a forum user called us out and said I was really disappointed that you guys were encouraging people to cheat the vote on the Emmy Awards, and said specifically, you know, that through Microsoft, that you guys basically did something that blocked everyone at Microsoft from being able to vote. And I'm like, what is this guy talking about? But, you know, before I rush to respond, I download the episode, listen to it again, and suddenly hear what I said and realized how painfully ambiguous it was. So let me read exactly what I said and then explain what it was I meant by that. What I said, and I quote, is, "I'll tell you right now, this is what happens when you unleash nerds upon a voting contest. My brother, of course, who works for Microsoft, says that they have a ton of internal IPs. He cycled through all of them. Every single one of them has been used for an abuse vote." Now, here's the point. The way that I said that could imply that he cycled through all of them. They've now been used for an abuse vote. Therefore, he is the one that did that.
That's what I thought you meant.
And that is not what I meant. Well, and I even wondered, because when we recorded the episode, John said, "You may get us disqualified." I'm like, why would this get us disqualified? Tex, do you want to correct the story here on what I was really trying to say?
Yes. So first off, I have not been abuse voting and I have not been using the Microsoft proxies to do so. I just said that, well, what happened was I remember they had to reset the votes. And so just within a few hours after that, I was at work. And so I went to go vote and it said the IP had already been used. And so I cycled through several of our CorpNet proxies and found that all of their IPs had already been used for voting. However, I was not the one who used them or voted with them. I just discovered that they had already been used for voting.
So somebody else abuse voted at Microsoft. Tex just cycled through them and found out that they had been used for abuse voting. So we know that someone there was doing it. It was not Tex nor anyone I'm aware of that was related to the show. I have no idea who this person is, who they were voting for, what they were voting for. And I'll put it to you guys this way. Sitting behind the mics right now is two professional programmers and one professional infrastructure guy. If we really wanted to cheat or encourage you guys to cheat,
we have much better ways of doing it.
Yeah, believe me. First of all, we'd have given you guys tutorials on how to do things like mask and roll your IPs. And secondly, we have much more sophisticated ways of doing this. So
yes, absolutely. First off, I am not a dishonest person. I don't do things like that. But if I was, I could come up with far more intelligent and clever ways to do it than just cycling through the CorpNet proxy pool.
So for those of you that walked away with the impression that we were stacking the vote, encouraging others to do so, please understand that was a combination of me speaking ambiguously along with tongue-in-cheek humor.
And beer.
There is a reason why we have never to date actually explained how to abuse the voting system, which is because we're not in favor of that. It's the same reason I don't play video games on God mode, because if you know you're going to win, what was the point of playing? You know, if we have an Emmy Award to accept at Gen Con, I want it to be because the people out there really do like Fear the Boot, not because we just so happen to have enough crooked computer nerds around here that we can go out there and stack the vote in our favor. it's, you know, the Annie Award's not that big of a deal to me. So,
well, and I would hope the judges at the Annie Awards are also smart enough to notice if someone's walking through a Class C subnet one IP at a time every 5 seconds.
Yeah. Well, or even to note the exact same vote being cast in rapid succession.
Yeah.
So,
you know what this means, don't you?
What?
Clearly, the good Baron is out to get us.
The Baron may be on our side.
I don't trust the Baron, and no one should.
No one should. But speaking of the good Baron, it is time to update, as what we have been saying is the more important vote than the Annie votes.
Yes.
The Power 16.
Wow. Excellent.
And it looks like we are climbing to new heights. It looks like we had about, almost 400 people participate. Ooh. This time around, unless they are also cycling through Microsoft's subnet stitching.
I'm vibrating.
But we have just two matches, because what this leads down to, this is the semifinals for the finals that will be started as of the release of the show and will run through the Wednesday before Gen Con. And what I'm going to do is, before I leave on that Thursday, I'm going to read the results, bring them with me to Gen Con, and at the impromptu episode we record at Gen Con, we will give the winner of the Power 16. So let's get down to your semifinals. First matchup was Baron Von Badass versus the Demon Gnome with a magic staff.
Gee, I wonder who won this
one. Yeah, that's a toughie.
Anyone here at all going to pick the Demon Gnome?
No.
Nope.
No? Okay. Yeah, it was a stomping.
I figured. Well, the Baron's stacking the vote.
This is somewhere in the neighborhood of a 4-1.
He practiced on the Power 16 and then moved on to the Ennies.
The Baron, with roughly 80% of the vote,
perfect,
just annihilated the Demon Gnome with the magic staff, proving that no matter how powerful your twink character is, the Game Master's cheesy NPC will always be more powerful. So
a reflection on gaming.
Let that be a warning to you. All right, now here's the close one. I didn't expect this to be close, but this was actually very close. Batman versus Vin Diesel.
Ooh.
I got to go Batman.
All right.
I got to go Batman.
I'll go Vin Diesel in this
one. We got a Vin Diesel text. We need a tiebreaker.
I'm going to have to go with Batman just because of his large disposable income.
Okay, you are correct. Batman apparently dipped into his own pocket to get out the vote here, did some campaigning.
He did, Adam.
And 198 to 179.
Ooh.
So a difference of 19 votes. Batman wins.
Not as close as the Phil, whoever Phil went up against.
The Phil and Don Shadowrun one. Oh, no, not Don Shadowrun. It's Phil and the Baron. The Baron. Yeah. Where the Baron only won by 6 votes. And I think if we had let Phil's episode drop,
I think so too,
afterwards,
or, I feel guilty.
Or rather, I mean, beforehand, that Phil would have taken that vote by landslide.
Yeah.
But the final match for the Power 16 that will be running from now until right before Gen Con is Baron Von Badass versus Batman.
Oh, man.
The ultimate bad guy versus the ultimate good guy, screw you, Tony, are going in a head-to-head crushing match to find out who the ultimate most powerful person is in the Power 16.
And by the way, I like Superman.
And then afterwards, isn't Dark Horse going to do an adaptation of it?
Yes, yeah, they
Batman
will.
Versus the Baron.
Well, they're going to have a some kind of like a multi-issue, you know, it's going to be all these versus issues that kind of explain the story behind this, leading up to like an epic battle. And once the whole series is run, we're going to come out with a trade paperback version. And
sweet.
So the good thing is they've already paid us the $5 million.
Is there really that big of a market for the battle between a morally ambiguous comic book character and a Game Master cliche?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
Look at all the Drizzt novels.
You
well.
Haven't been around long enough to get your check.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, look at Ari Salvatore.
He's doing just fine with his GM character.
Speaking of artwork, right now, this podcast is being recorded in the lower level of my split level home. However, upstairs are 3 bedrooms, and Carl and I have no kids, so we basically have 2 extra bedrooms. And we have decided that we are going to relocate the recording equipment up to one of those bedrooms, which I'm going to turn into a combination podcast recording studio and also just general office for my writing and the other things that I do. And I would really like to be able to decorate that, because I have very few decorations, with things that either I have created or other people have created that have artistically or creatively inspired me over the years. The problem is these things either have no artwork at all or have no good artwork. And so what I am looking to do, and I brought this up months and months and months ago, and I'd like to re-pursue it, is if you are an artist who was willing to do some commission artwork on some custom subject material that I will describe to you, please let me know. Send me an email. And if you have samples, be sure to attach them. And I'm going to give you a different email address because my dan@feartheboot.com actually has kind of a small email box size. So send these to feartheboot, one word, @gmail.com, which has a very big mailbox size. And the style that I'm looking for is realistic. So if you draw Amerimanga, nothing against your artwork, but I'm looking for more of a photorealistic, you know, I want these things to look like what they're supposed to look like. And it's mostly people. There's a couple monsters. There's a couple bits of scenery like capital ships in space. But once again, it's mostly people. So if you are interested, please send an email with a sample of your work or a link or something to feartheboot@gmail.com. And just to be clear, this is not a contest. This is not a...
I win.
This is not a quid pro quo. This is not a, you know, you do this, we'll give you fame. This is, you do the art, I write you a check. So, just...
They're not even going to cash the check. They're just going to frame it.
Yeah, they're going to frame it. Because my signature, it's a signed check from Dan.
Go on eBay.
So, anyway, if you're interested in that, let us know. And while we're on the topic of artwork, we have artwork of a different kind. Jim in Buffalo...
Sorry, Jim.
...has written us a song about the mighty Baron von Badass, and please don't let this influence your upcoming voting, but he wrote us a song about the mighty Baron von Badass.
We need a bat song.
That he already has one. It's stupid.
Well, I would say it's only fair because Batman already has theme music.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah,
but the only good music to come out of Batman movies, not counting the orchestral pieces from Batman Begins, was U2's Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me.
Well, you're stepping on toes here. If you're saying that Prince did not rock out the first Batman soundtrack.
The Bat Dance.
And several other tracks.
The Bat Dance.
I have to be offended on behalf of my wife.
The Bat Dance.
The Bat Dance is great. It sums up everything that's good about Batman.
Does your wife listen to this podcast?
Yeah.
Hold on. Before I even finish this Jim and Buffalo thing, how does the Bat Dance sum up anything good about anything?
Have you ever listened to the Bat Dance all the way through?
Yes, I have listened to the Bat Dance. I was in a junior high band where they made us play the Bat Dance.
I really don't have an answer. If you've heard it and you can't come to that conclusion on your own.
You know,
when I hear it, it takes me back to the days of new comics.
We've been doing this podcast for a year and a couple months now.
Right.
We've never once wandered into territory where I felt uncomfortable.
Adam feel uncomfortable. I've done my job. I am all right.
Bat Dance?
How can you not like the Bat Dance? It's
danceable.
I've never
heard the Bat Dance, and I don't want to. I resist change, sir.
You should, in this case. But anyway, Jim's song is not the Bat Dance, nor is it the Baron von Badass Dance. And Prince, please don't write one. But
watch the Baron dance.
I told Jim that I was going to link this off the show notes like an episode or two ago, and then just completely forgot.
You bat forgot.
I bat forgot. It bat danced out of my mind in a princely fashion. So if we will put that in the show notes. If you're interested in hearing his take on the Baron von Badass theme song, we will link that off the show notes. Just go to feartheboot.com and you can check that
out. You know what the best part about that song is?
What?
There's a sound effect on the train dirigible.
Oh. Jim's one. I thought you meant the Bat Dance.
No.
My dig there was against the Bat Dance, just to be clear, not Jim's song. So, anywho. All righty.
Are we actually going to talk about a topic now?
Yes. Yes. We have important news to get past before we get down to topics. All right.
What, more?
No.
Oh, okay.
We're done. If you'd shut up, I'd be on the topic by now.
Go.
All right. Favorite video game based on a tabletop RPG?
I have an answer.
Now, I'm not asking for anyone's favorite computer role-playing game. So Final Fantasy is not an acceptable answer.
Right.
Favorite video game that was specifically based on a tabletop RPG. Tabletop RPG existed. Video game was made. Favorite one.
Would something like Neverwinter Nights count?
It's
D&D, but it's not like a BattleTech game where the whole feel and story of the game is completely based on BattleTech. They just use the system.
They also use the setting.
Well, I thought KOTOR, Knights of the Old Republic 1 and 2, did a decent job of adapting the D20 Star Wars system.
I've never played KOTOR.
And I played, Baldur's KOTOR? Gate back in Windows 95. Gosh, that's coming up on 10 years ago now. I don't think it was quite that long.
See, I was going to go with Baldur's Gate.
Wasn't bad. It was turn-based combat, and they actually made an attempt at dealing with party alignment.
You know, one of the things I appreciated about Baldur's Gate was the fact that you play the single-player game multiplayer.
That was cool.
That was awesome.
That was cool.
Tim would come over, and we would roll up the party. And I can't remember how it worked, but he would play two or three guys, and I would play two or three guys.
Yeah, my brothers and I did that.
And we would play through the single-player game, and that was a load of fun. I have to... Hats off to Baldur's Gate for that. And if you're a video game developer, there are those of us out there that don't have anything to prove and like playing these games cooperatively.
Oh, nuh-uh. I gotta win.
And some of us love playing, you know, 16 other people in the Shadowrun universe, blowing each other up, flying around, teleporting through walls, because it is awesome no matter what the rest of you guys say.
All right, let's talk about a video game that's not based on a tabletop RPG. It just has the same name.
It's got, you've got elves, you've got dwarves, you've got all the fancy races, you've got magic, you've got cyber technology. How is that not the epitome of Shadowrun? Okay. Shadowrun sprouts from that.
Well, since I'm holding a brand new copy of it in the box, did you want to segue into the contest, Dan?
No, because we actually haven't figured out how we're going to give that stuff away yet. But just to let you guys know, since Tex has dropped this, I have to explain it now.
Dude, you can edit this. Don't blame that on me.
Oh, I'm lazy. Tex comes bearing gifts again. He comes bearing three Xbox 360 games and one Windows Vista game that we'll be giving away somehow, somewhere, some when. We just haven't figured out how yet.
We're busy solving world issues.
Well, actually, we do have another contest idea that I'm not ready to announce yet, for which we'll have to come up with different prizes. So
stay tuned, because we may or may not have new contests.
No, stay tuned. We will have new contests. We just haven't worked out the minutiae yet. All right, favorite video game based on a tabletop RPG?
I think
Shadowrun doesn't count.
Shadowrun doesn't count?
No.
It's a blast.
If you want to give me the old Genesis Shadowrun, that will count.
No game has made me feel like a Shadowrunner, like the new Shadowrun, because I am messing things up, and it's a good time. Now, okay, if you want me to go more traditional, nostalgia wins, D&D, Gold Box, Curse of the Azure Bond.
Ooh.
Because it was fantastic.
That was a great game for its time. You know what, and actually that is the reason why when I run D&D, I run Forgotten Realms in that era, is because of Curse of the Azure Bonds. I had a great
system
time.
What system was
this on? This would have been D&D 2nd Edition.
No, what gaming system?
Oh, this would have been like...
PC, way back when.
IBM, like... Ugh. 286 or 386, and
everybody's a little sprite.
Apple two C's and Apple two E's. This was way, way, way back. Great RPG though.
Oh, it was fantastic. All the Gold Box games, well, not all of them, but a good portion of those Gold Box games were very tied to the setting. Very good in Forgotten Realms, and were a really good introduction to computer gamers to RPGs. I think.
I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. There's Pool of Radiance, the original one,
and the Pool of the Darkness later on. That was one of the last Gold Box games.
Well, I actually had a bit of a reverse initiation there, because I had played some of those computer games on our Apple IIc before I'd actually played Dungeons & Dragons, and it was completely counterintuitive to me that I could cast a magic spell once and then had to go to bed before I could cast it again.
That's why I don't play mages. I need a mana pool,
I don't think,
and it needs to come back.
For mine, I have to go with one of two, and I'm gonna get this down to one, just because it's favorite. It's not list of favorite, but it's going to be a split between two BattleTech video games, both of which did a really good job of following the BattleTech and MechWarrior rules, which was Crescent Hawk's Inception and the original MechWarrior. MechWarrior 2 through 4, they were basically glorified shooters, but MechWarrior 1 actually stuck to the BattleTech map combat rules. A PPC only fired like once every 10 seconds. And if it hit something, it did a tremendous amount of damage. If I had to pick one of them to go with, I would have to go with Crescent Hawk's Inception, just because it was role-playing as well. That you had the mechs, but you had this whole big world you could wander. There was plots going on. You got to have parties, and you could do different things and follow different paths.
Well, and you could do different things outside of your mechs, which I think is the most important distinction, is that in a lot of those games where you kind of, you know, quote-unquote RP, basically your mech is docked and you get some dialogue boxes while your mech is docked. But
right,
in this particular case, you could actually exit the mech and walk around and do things on foot.
Yeah, well, even your dudes on foot, like if you had pilots that didn't have mechs, they could, like, take SRMs and such and get involved in combat.
Could you put them on your shoulders and just have them snipe?
Well, there were some AI, I don't want to use the word, well, yeah, I do want to use the word exploits there, because the AI would consider a mech to be a far larger threat than an infantry guy.
Yeah.
And so I remember you could actually put the infantry guys with the SRMs out in front of the mechs, and the enemy mechs would just walk right past them getting SRM'd the whole until they got to your mechs.
The better exploit was you gave them all infernos, and of course most of those mechs only had 10 heat sinks. If you get just two guys with infernos, it's only a matter of time before you shut the mech down from heat, and then you just disassemble it.
Yeah, because the vast majority of the mechs in that game were light mechs, so they didn't have hardly any.
They were
insects.
All, outside of the one chameleon, they were all light mechs.
Yeah, the chameleon, I think, was the only medium mech.
That was my only disappointment with the game, was they only gave you a handful of light mechs. They never gave you any mediums or heavies outside of that one chameleon. And they make reference to the Phoenix Hawk, but it never actually appears in the game.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, it appears in one picture, but... All right, Adam.
I'm actually going to go with Neverwinter Nights.
Really?
I would have gone with Baldur's Gate, but I liked what they did with Neverwinter Nights, trying to create those DM tools.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm not saying that they were good, but I applaud the effort.
I played a few good modules based on those. They ended up being fun.
The fan modules were awesome.
Yeah, exactly. The fan modules were great.
Some of the fan modules were awesome.
I think that goes without saying.
Like, some of the Half-Life level were awesome, and most of them not. So I have to applaud the effort there.
Yeah. Of course, I hear they dropped the ball on 2. My computer won't run.
I didn't play 2. Yeah. That's why I didn't go with 2.
I picked up Neverwinter Nights 1 for one reason and one reason only. The language surrounding the game, like the marketing, was very, very ambiguous about whether you could host your own persistent worlds or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked it up thinking I could,
and you can.
And Mike, Tim, and I, we had this thing figured out where we were each going to build different sections of this huge setting and basically run our own MMO, and then found out you can't without using all these different third-party hacks, which I don't want to get caught up in doing. So when Neverwinter Nights 2 was slated, I went on the forums and searched around until I found a spot where a community mod or developer or somebody specifically said, no, we will not be supporting persistent worlds, and I basically said, okay, that's fine, then I will not be spending $60 on your game. And never picked it up.
I never played 2 because, well, I don't even really know why. I just didn't.
You're just curmudgeon-y like that.
I had nothing against it. I wanted to play it. I just never did. I mean, I wish it was an interesting story where I find $5 at the end, but I did not.
I was just curious to see if you guys were actually really going to see that through, because I remember when you were talking about it, I was somewhat leery of you guys understanding the amount of work it takes to create a persistent world or create enough content to interest somebody for more than 10 minutes.
The answer is yes. In fact, I wasted a good deal of my life building a large portion of that world before I finally got it clarified that persistent worlds were not supported, were not going to be supported by the expansions, and the third-party tools to make them support, at least at the time, were not really user-friendly. And it was a whole lot of hacking and jury-rigging to make anything work right.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that the system was flawless.
Okay, because we had a similar problem when XNA first came out, that a lot of 13-year-olds downloaded XNA and thought they could just go right-click Master Chief and have Halo. And
you can't do that?
Didn't understand that video game design, even with a wonderful tool set, still a little bit more work than
right.
that.
Lies.
No, we had it, and believe me, we actually had some really cool stuff. Using their sound effects and lighting effects, we had some really cool areas set up. I mean, just some very original content, and it just, we could never do anything with it. So I think it finally got lost when I had to reformat a computer, and it's like, I don't even care that it's gone.
See, and there's a niche that really hasn't been filled. You know, if we could have a game where you could make your own persistent worlds, even if it did require a bit of work, I think that could be a big hit.
I am aware of one. Years ago, there was a game called Shattered Light that was designed to make your own persistent world MMO.
Hmm.
They were going to follow it up with a game called Fantasy Lord. And basically what happened is when they tried to get the funding to do it, to make this build your own MMO kit, and Shattered Light was very old school. It was sprites and there was no trade skills and whatever.
Sure.
It was very much a stripped down version of UO. But with this Fantasy Lord one, it actually looked really cool. They had some great ideas. They took it to a gaming convention, and at the gaming convention, they basically said that nobody wanted to back it. They said really the only thing we're interested in is having hot chicks in it. And so the guys ended up basically throwing in the towel. And yes, Jim, I got it right this time.
Not the hat.
They threw in the towel and instead went over to making stripper simulators. And
now they're probably rich.
Yeah, probably.
I know, but I every so often send them an email berating them and telling them to get back to making Fantasy Lord. Because
you know what we should do? We have like 2,000 Fear the Boot programmers. We need to turn them loose in all these wild game ideas we have.
I need minions. That's the problem.
The Fear the Boot video game camp?
We have listeners.
We need to play Overlord then.
We have listeners. I don't have minions. So I want cyborgs or robots or something. I don't know. I need to remove some ethical barriers.
Yeah, robots can raise up and, you know,
we need mutiny. You know what we need? We need minions.
You know
we have so many ideas that we really want people to do.
that we don't have time to do.
You go make this happen.
Okay. You know what else we need to do is actually get on some more content here. Oh. So Luke brought up a great topic idea that was for our British listeners that we are going to chase here. Knowing when to update or not update the versions of your RPG. Now, this is a topic that we never could have done before, because the problem was one of the few things that was unanimously true about all of the hosts behind the mics was every single one of us played games who had a copyright date no later than like the mid-90s. And
that was the new games.
Luke here is brave, and he's played things that have been written since like the internet.
And beyond, even. As early as even a few months ago, the game was written that I own.
So, he brought up the question, and I guess we could kind of respond to this, because like with the D&D 2.0 versus 3.0...
I'll do 3.0 to 3.5.
I won't. You have all this stuff invested in your old version, or maybe in our case even, it's an old game, you know, BattleTech or the Shadowrun 2nd Edition or whatever, and all of a sudden this new edition comes out, or maybe even a brand new game comes out. How do you make that decision that it is time to update versus just clinging on to your old stuff?
I have observed this odd phenomenon and been a part of it too, because I don't even understand it, but cruising around various forums over the years, people do not want to play games that aren't supported anymore, even if they're not going to buy anything again. It just seems like once a game they say, nope, it's done, it's over, they just move on. They move on to stuff that's actively supported, and there's really no reason for it. I mean, no, there's no one to say the rules are going to be better or better designed, but it happens, and it happens all the time, and I've done it. So,
well, I think if you have a very steady RP group that has universally made that investment in a product line, then you have that luxury, as Dan said, because all of us have, you know, 20-year-old copies of BattleTech, or all of us have 15-year-old copies of Shadowrun, we can get away with things like that. But let's pretend we were trying to expand the group, or we're going to include someone who didn't have those resources and they couldn't get them. It would be somewhat more difficult to do that. Or also, I guess this is a little bit more appropriate to wargaming, but could also apply to role playing, is if you wanted to go out to conventions or to play competitively, then you would have to have the most
currency. I was going to say,
war games are like
that. Yeah, Games Workshop in particular does just these crushing maneuvers with that, where when they release a new edition, if you want to go to their big tournaments, you've got to have the latest edition rule books. Your army may have changed. The units you have on the field may now no longer be supported, or may have been made obsolete by more powerful units of similar point cost. And you've got to go out not just rebuy your books, but rebuy your armies and everything.
Yeah, Dan and I were actually talking about this beforehand. GW forced both of us out of Warhammer and Warhammer 40K because when they updated, they didn't carry our armies forward the way we wanted them to.
Right.
So why would we, you know, I've invested all this money and time in an army, and all of a sudden it either doesn't play like it used to, not how I want to play, or for me, I had Wood Elves in 5th edition and was waiting for that book for 3 years before I would have got rules. What's the point of me even playing?
Right, yeah, and in my case, I was playing 40K, 2nd edition, I was playing Combination Tyranids Gene Stealer Cult. They dropped the Gene Stealer Cults completely and then changed the Tyranids from a quality over quantity army into a quantity over quality army.
Which, minor change.
Yeah, destroyed the feel of the Tyranid to me. And so it's basically like, at this point, if I was an avid 40K player, I would have no choice but to go out and reinvest in new books, new army, new everything. And I instead chose the alternate route of just quitting. But
well, I had a similar painful parting a couple days ago. I actually finally broke down and caved in, and I cleaned a lot of my Necromunda and Warhammer Fantasy Battles and Warhammer 40K stuff out of the closet, and gave a lot of it to the neighbor kids because he plays. And so he was able to reuse a lot of my models, because a lot of what I had was like Mark 7 Space Marines, which the models are still good.
Ooh, the Beaky.
But no, those are the Mark 6s.
Oh, I'm dumb.
Anyway, but I had given him all my old 3rd edition box sets, and he was kind of going through the rule books, and I was having to explain to him that those rule books are useless to you unless those are the only ones you're going to use, or you happen to find people that have those old rule books. But otherwise, you know, use them for your recreational reading pleasure, but you're going to understand that the rule books, aside from the pretty little artwork, are going to be useless to you if you want to go out to a GW store or play with your friends at school that have the newer rules.
So, you know, let me talk this through to the couple games I have updated. Because with games like Battletech, I've never had to move from Battletech to something newer because of the fact that the people I play with all own or enjoy the classic Battletech rules. With something like 40K, because of the cost investment, time investment, and I wasn't that huge of a 40K fan to begin with, I just dropped it. But let's take a game I did update.
Here we go.
D&D.
This is the most complained about upgrade I have ever heard.
The reason I went from 2.0 to 3.0 was because of the fact, partially because of the fact that I had friends who were jumping on that bandwagon. And so there was certainly some social pressure there. But it was also because I really felt like with 3.0, they made modifications to the game that were meaningful. And as the phrase we use many times in this podcast, I felt like in many ways they took the game outward, not just upward. It wasn't like, oh, we just made everything more powerful and you're screwed if you don't use this edition. They actually revised the game in meaningful ways that changed my gameplay experience. The most simple one I can grab is that they balanced the classes. In 2.0, the classes were not balanced. They just had different XP charts. You know, a thief hit level 20 long before a wizard did. But a level 20 wizard's a heck of a lot more powerful than a level 20 thief. Whereas in third edition, they took it the opposite direction and balanced them out to where everyone has the same XP chart and ideally, or the intention was, has basically the same power level at the same level. So in third edition, I actually saw some things I liked that second edition didn't have that made me want to actually upgrade. There was a point to the upgrade.
I've never played second edition.
You missed out.
I hear that a lot. But
granted, I cut my teeth on it. It's a little bit nostalgia.
I cut my teeth on 3.0.
Ooh, so
I started gaming when, like, the first game we played, 2 weeks after we started it, 3.0 came out. We went to the midnight release party.
You know, you're probably missed out on the ultimate edition of D&D. You probably never even seen the book, The Rule Encyclopedia. Phenomenal. It is everything you need in D&D, except for, you know, it's back when races were classes. And that's when it was really good.
I've heard that joke.
I have those sitting in, actually right there in that laundry room right there.
Absolutely, seriously, one of my favorite RPG books. It is everything you need for a campaign in D&D right there. It's a great book.
I've got tons of adventure modules and all kinds of stuff from first edition D&D that somebody gave me back in high school. It's because this actually would have even predated my time gaming, but somebody in high school gave these to me. By the time I started gaming, D&D was in its second edition.
But, same here, but we went back.
But you know, along those lines, let's flip this around now. When do you decide not to update?
Well,
the clans.
Yeah.
Boom.
Number one, they take the story in a direction you don't like.
Yeah, that's one way. That's actually what happened when White Wolf updated to World of Darkness 2.0, is they said, hey, we're going to reset everything. And a lot of fans said, well, we've invested so much. You know, why are you doing this? You know, we want this. And they're like, we've told the story we want. And it's become a problem for new players like myself. When I finally got into World of Darkness, there was so much bloated canon that everybody loved but me, because I had no access to it. And I didn't want to read 40 books to catch up. When they reset it, I'm like, this is great. It's starting at zero. I can get in on the ground floor. And it was fun for me again.
I've seen this with Battletech. That with Battletech, there was so much canon written and established on the game that when we would bring in new Battletech players, they would oftentimes, I mean, we'd just be throwing back and forth inside knowledge and inside jokes that they just absolutely could not follow. Even with a homebrew, with Epoch of Rysos, or Danvers, as we tend to call it, I ran that recently for a group of people, and I had to be very careful how I ran it because too many people played it for too long. And so I had to start the game. It's like, okay, you're in this really narrow section of the universe dealing with really narrow sets of events, because if I drop you full bore into the world as I know it, or as my players know it, you're going to be lost. It's just, you're going to be drowning in a sea of proper nouns.
Well, a lot of that even did happen. I mean,
yeah, well, even still,
that's a player thing though. And well, if you get too familiar with the setting, then, well, this happens. Well, is this a smaller part of this thing that I know is happening elsewhere in the world? No.
Now, there's also the really bad way to update games, and that would be what I consider the Star Wars D20 bottom dropping out. They came out with Star Wars D20. I was like, ooh, ooh, Star Wars D20. This is what I'm still excited about.
So you actually bought the book and read it?
I bought the original one, yeah, the first one, because, you know, it's an upgrade from D6, and I thought. And I liked it. It was fine. I never actually ran or played it, but I thought it was
if
worthwhile.
If the number's bigger, it must be an upgrade.
There you go. Well, bigger dice equals upgrade. Six.
I mean, but more D's has got to be better.
But then instead of releasing just source books to update for the new movies, they came out with another edition and they changed the rules. And then they just did it again about 6 months ago. So within within like 5 years, you've got three editions to the rules, which are kind of compatible, but it's kind of ridiculous. And I know people who bought all three and I'm like,
yeah, I think that's part of the biggest thing that motivates me not to upgrade is the fact that I look around and I say between the games I own and between the homebrews I've written, I'm satisfied.
Yeah, there we go. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
It's like, you know, what really keeps me from upgrading in a lot of ways is that I look at these games that are sitting on the shelf and I don't see a lot they offer that I'm not already getting out of my older games or my homebrews. And it takes something like a D&D 3.0 where I really feel like it changes the game in a meaningful, useful way to push me to upgrade. Now, having said that, I do understand where if you've got a newer group or newer people in the group, that maybe upgrading is easier because they can get the books. They're not buried under 10 years of canon that they don't know. You know, everyone's kind of starting on the same page and at the same level again.
Can I unpaint myself from that corner before the emails start flying in at me? You're not an idiot if you bought all three versions. Not for real.
Come on. Lee's the best way to get emails.
I know. But, well, besides making fun of Serenity. But if you were getting it to get, you know, all the stats on the new stuff, which you need in games, I can see that. You know, if you're really excited about Star Wars, if you're like me who dabbles, then you're probably an idiot. I would have been an idiot to buy all three.
Speaking of which, if you're interested in talking to our new host, I will add them to our contact page, and you will also, as of the release of this episode, be able to contact them at luke@feartheboot.com and tex@feartheboot.com. So if you have questions or comments for them, you can use the email contact form or write them directly at those addresses. Now, Luke, as the one person at the table who does still regularly go out and shop for new games, what is it primarily that motivates you forget versions of games. What motivates you primarily to go out and buy brand new games despite the vast library you already have at home?
It's the quest for the Holy Grail is what it is. I'm always looking for a game that's better, a game that can do what I want a little better than previous games. And I'm okay with even if it has just the idea, you know, a mechanic that really works that I can adapt to something else. Because I'm all for stealing from one system and kludging it into another if I have to. It's
Have you actually cherry picked from various systems and put together a system that your friends play?
I have before. Sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't. But usually, lately I've just been sticking with one system that I know very well that pretty much does everything I want. I've pretty much found my Holy Grail, so I don't have to go out and buy like I used to. But I used to buy, I said it last time, for a few years, I bought almost every major release that came out. My shelf is bloated with books games I'll never play, but I thought would have something worthwhile. I never good read, you know, some of them, but I'll never touch them.
What is your Holy Grail?
Savage Worlds.
I figured that or Spirit of the Sanctuary. And what makes Savage Worlds your Holy Grail?
Because it caters to my GM style. It's very fast, it's very loose, and the whole goal, one of the design goals of Savage Worlds was to cut down on GM prep time, which is what I hate.
Right.
I don't want to spend hours writing up stats. If I'm spending hours on a game, I'm developing the world, I'm developing the people, I'm developing the plot. And Savage Worlds lets me do that, and stats just come naturally.
All right. Let me tell you how I spend my weekends. On a typical Saturday, you can find me on my front porch in a rocking chair with a quilt across my lap, shotgun next to me, 15-year-old bloodhound sleeping on the ground beside me, screaming at kids with a Battletech compendium in my lap. 10 years from now, do you see yourself being that way, except instead of a Battletech compendium, it's your Savage Worlds book? Or do you think you're going to keep chasing these new systems?
No, you know, I think I've settled because it's been, let's see, it was released in 2003, and I've been on board for that long, and it still remained my number one. Now, like I said, there's other games that have come out that have stuff I like you know, Rules to Run Countries that are easy, that I'll probably port over or do something with. And if games come out like that that have a system that I like that Savage Worlds doesn't have,
right,
I might pick those up.
It's called Skies of Glass. It's wonderful.
So right now, the big news in the literary world,
Snape kills Dumbledore,
is,
oh my god,
Moaning Myrtle eats Hermione.
Voldemort is chocolate.
Delicious chocolate, yes!
Is, of course, the release of the seventh Harry Potter book. And this brought up a question while we were sitting around before the mics were turned on. Why is there no Harry Potter RPG?
And now, actually, the question before the mics were on were, why is Levicorpus in the movie of the fifth book when he doesn't learn it until the sixth book?
No, that was not at all the question before.
It should have been.
Man, you're worse than a Star Trek fan.
You know, there are podcasts that cover that.
I'm sure there are podcasts that have devoted three episodes to it. All right, but that was not our question. Our question was, why is there not an official Harry Potter RPG? And to which I, in my ignorance, sitting there in my quilt in a rocking chair on my front lawn.
Because you don't read the FTV
respond,
forums.
I thought there was an official Harry Potter RPG. And I am then told, very promptly by Luke and by Adam, that there is not. And now here's what stunned me. Do you guys want to repeat the reason why there isn't?
This is Luke's reason.
Okay, I'm going to take credit for this because I know I've read it in multiple internet sources. That's not Wikipedia. So this may or may not be true. Yeah, the reason I heard is because J.K. Rowling hates RPGs, and I've heard her quoted to say they rot the brain. But that, again, may not be true. This is speculation.
I don't care if it's not true. Let's just run with it.
Okay, it's true. It's true. It's totally true. I think she wrote that in the epilogue, in fact, of 7.
Right there at the end.
RPGs killed Dumbledore.
I'm just sitting here choking in the irony that we're taking internet unsubstantiated hyperbole and spinning it back onto the internet.
Well, no, there's no irony in that.
We built a podcast on that.
No, the irony I'm choking on is twofold here. One is the fact that the same crowd that derides RPGs is also typically the same crowd that derides Harry Potter.
Agree.
For the exact same reasons. Okay. This is a math. So this is shocking to me. All right. This is like Ozzy Osbourne getting mad at someone over making heavy metal. I mean, this right there, there's an irony to that. The second thing is, if you ask most people, what do you think in modern entertainment today, what media is rotting the mind? They'll typically say passive entertainment, TV and movies. And here she is churning out these movies.
And books.
And books. Well, but books, you know, at least it's reading. Right. You know, it engages your mind.
It's not as passive, but it's going to be a large stretch for you to tell me that books are active.
They're not interactive, okay, unless we're talking to Choose Your Own Adventure.
Because I'm
not
on this big anti-book.
But having said that, as you read, you know, it does engage a large part of your mind. Depending on the kind of reader you are, you may even engage multiple parts of your mind. You might visualize things or hear voices. You do imagine things that the book doesn't say. You picture characters and voices.
I'm with you.
All right. So here's my point, though. To say that RPGs rot the mind while cranking out movies, baffles me.
From the richest
woman
in Europe.
I have a completely different unsubstantiated theory.
Ooh, I
so
like this.
This is Tex's unsubstantiated theory, which is based on absolutely nothing, not even something I read off the internet.
Is it sexually salacious?
No.
Damn.
My thought is because from the interviews I've seen of the author, she wrote a great deal of the universe and the canon and actually kind of wrote herself a little encyclopedia about the universe back when she started to write book one. And so it's my understanding that she's very active with the making of the movies, and it's allowing her to keep creative control over her intellectual property, for lack of a better word. And I believe a role-playing game would take away a lot of her control over the universe, or would pass control of the intellectual property in a sanctioned way away from her. I mean, of course, the fans are already doing all kinds of things anyway.
Yeah, those slash fics aren't taken away at all.
Yeah, but she's come down on those. She's had sites shut down with the
slash fic.
Yeah,
really.
Right. So
the Snape and Harry stuff.
My personal view is that that's
the secret of
she
book
has
seven.
A very
Snape bones Dumbledore. Well, she's
I'm sorry. Dumbledore's corpse.
Touch my wand.
I'm sorry, Tex. Please continue.
Oh no, I was just saying that my personal view is that she probably has a great deal of desire to control or to moderate or to keep creative control of that Harry Potter universe and is very reluctant to allow third parties, especially without her control, to alter that universe in any kind of sanctioned way.
You know, and I can see that on two levels. One, that is in the writing of the RPG alone, you have to put down on paper and explain things that she may have never thought out the story. Because the story, of course, follows a select group of characters in a select series of places. If you want to write an RPG, you now suddenly have to talk about other characters and potentially wildly different places. Second subpart of thing one is that you now have to start writing rule mechanics to define and consolidate ideas that she was simply using as story devices.
And you hit it on the head there, I think, for anybody who wants to design this RPG. The problem with doing that is putting rules to the magic system, which has really no rules.
Well, you're right. The entire magic system was meant as a literary device, and I'm not sure she necessarily was putting mana costs and casting times and cooldown limits and things like that on the spells.
Well, I will agree with that. It is not fleshed out to that level, but I think you're also assuming that just because it's a literary device, that it is inconsistent. And from book one to book seven, she does have a consistency to it.
Now, I'm not saying it's inconsistent.
Okay, well, that's what I'm saying, but I don't want you to fall into the trap of saying, well, it's just a literary device, and spells work when they want to and don't. I'm just saying that it is consistent enough that if you were to come up with a formula, I think it could be done.
Well, I think it'd be very difficult. I didn't mean to imply that her writing is inconsistent, because it's absolutely not inconsistent, but my implication was that I'm not sure she necessarily thought out a balanced class and combat
system.
And
I agree with you. Yeah, and I agree. Completely. Right. I'm just saying, I don't want to fall into that trap.
Thought 1C, third part of that, see, I'm getting into nested lists now, man. This show's moving forward. Thought 1C is that now on top of that, under creative control, you also have to allow for expansion.
Yes.
That if you're going to keep selling an RPG, you can't stop at one rule book, and all of a sudden you have to have an expansion for the school in France, or the school in America, or the school in whatever, that suddenly
I play a Durmstrang campaign
once again, may kind of push outside of what she intended. Now, the second way in which she loses creative control is when people sit down to play it.
Yeah, then it's gone.
They aren't following her intended experience. You are doing whatever you want. But I guess, you know, what shocks me is the fact that that's not what she complains about. She doesn't complain that I had a certain story in mind, and I'm afraid that people would mutate that story, but that RPGs rot the mind.
Yeah, I can understand them not wanting to mutate your creation. I mean, if people started chopping up this show and then using various sound bits for their own devious ends.
Balls of steel.
Then it would be fantastic.
I agree.
Well, before we fixate too much on the rot the mind quote, do we actually have that from a substantial, reliable source?
No.
Or is this just a third party, some guy on the internet said that she said explicitly
that she will not allow anybody to write the Harry Potter RPG.
And as for the rot the mind, again, I've heard multiple sources on that, but it's the internet. So we could look it up and find internet referring to other internet sources.
Well, even if we didn't come up with the rot your mind thing, I mean, just speculating wildly on why she would be so militant about not allowing people to build an RPG around her story is
a lot more fun than the truth, right?
Yeah, I like to speculate wildly. I mean,
way more fun. Way
it's worked
fun.
For 63 episodes so far, huh?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe even her official ban aside, there are several unofficial RPGs out
Correct.
There. Is that, and that is
there? Well,
there's a great deal of unofficial Harry Potter material out there.
I know there was a source book for D20 called Redhurst Academy of Magic that was had a lot of fluff, was a really cool read, and it had a neat thing where it actually went around to a lot of different OGL campaign worlds. So, you know, you'd go into Dark Sun or Planescape or, some of the other third-party ones at the time, they'd tell you where the school showed up at. So that was actually kind of a cool approach to it, even if the D&D rules don't really work for the whole wizard school thing. Not well.
I'm just waiting for the expansion to Flight Simulator 10 to have Quidditch.
You interrupted Dan. He was reading spoilers.
No. Actually, what Dan was looking, I was trying to real quick see if perusing the internet, I could find some validated thing that, yeah, she really did say this.
Well, I suppose I'm a little personally sensitive to this because I do keep a close eye on the Xbox.com forums, and people post stuff all day, every day that's not true.
Well,
I'm going to start quoting you in all my posts.
I'm getting the same thing that Luke was talking about, where it's like I can find tons and tons and tons of sites that are all saying she has refused to allow one. But once again, I can't. I'm having trouble finding like an Associated Press article where they ask her about this, and you know she goes off on them or something. Yeah. So this, I don't know. I've got to think it's true, just given the landslide of information. But truth isn't determined by majority vote, right. So it may not be true. But the point is, either way, there is not one out there. And if anyone was making one, it would have been a massive announcement. And I've heard no such announcement, and I do keep up with the community better than I just about. And so it's like, the point is, there isn't one, and there isn't one coming out. So
well,
we can
I do
at least...
know that there are Harry Potter video games. I mean, there's actually a plethora of Harry Potter video games. But I think, again, if she had a tight relationship with a video game developer, she could maintain creative control.
Adam, as someone who has read all the books, and I believe, Luke, you've read all or most of them. Text, how many of them have you read?
I have read all of them except the most recent.
Okay.
Oh, go read it!
Get it
all
now.
All right. Having said that, I've seen the movies. I've not read the books. I do intend to. It's on my great stack of many books I intend to read.
Should read those soon.
I can't. The next 3 or 4 weeks are going to be hell for me. Once Gen Con's over, get back to me. But having said that, what do you guys think, if you were going to sit down and write an official Harry Potter RPG, what would the tough spots be? What do you think these unofficial RPGs are having to struggle with the most?
Do you take the approach of going in the entire Harry Potter world so you have the setting and you can explore everything you want? Or do you take it the route of, let's make the RPG based in a wizarding school and follow you through your 7 years classes and make it like the books? Which route do you take?
I'd go with the rules and the magic, actually.
I see that on two parts, scope and experience. Scope meaning how much of the world do you really want to define, which may include inventing things outside of what, you know, things she alluded to but never actually said. And then the second is, like I said, experience. That are you designing it such that you could play just some random wizard who has nothing to do with any of the schools or the Ministry of Magic or whatever, just goes out and does wizardly things in the world, whatever those might be?
Well, you have to go to the schools
but
to get
see,
licensed.
To me, it's...
Well, yeah, but let's say you're 35.
Okay.
You're a 35-year-old computer programmer who's a graduate of Hogwarts.
Oh, man. You can use your owls and newts as a character sheet.
That would,
I think
no,
the problem
that
you
would
have
be awesome.
Is
that is cool.
So if you look, though, at the bulk of her stories, they are set in a exclusively wizardly setting. Now, the book may start in the Muggle world, and it may conclude in the Muggle world, but the vast majority of the setting takes place in an environment where it's exclusively wizards. So ostensibly, everybody there has equal access to magical powers. But I think, especially in a role-playing game, if you were to throw the wizards out into dealing more with the Muggle universe, or say if there was, you know, Muggle on wizard crime or something like that, how would you handle the disparity in power? You know, how would you handle the fact that a wizard can just flick their wand and light things on fire, or that huge disparity in the power of a magical class versus a non-magical class? And then would you deal with things like, you know, could a wizard be killed by a gun? And if so, now you've got Shadowrun.
Yeah. I see the same kind of thing in World of Darkness. And I think World of Darkness works out a little bit better because, like, for example, the power level between a vampire and a regular human is just, it's massive. I mean, it's
level 5 and a peasant.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the way they got around this in Hunters Hunted was by giving humans various edges. For example, firepower. That if you can gun down a vampire. The second thing was they started allowing humans access to things that vampires didn't have, like faith. That if you took various points in faith and you were like a very religious or very spiritual person, that you could drive back a vampire in the name of the Lord. And I don't see her universe. It just strikes me that things like that play no role in her universe. Because,
well,
I mean,
right. I mean, you see that at the start of every book where the Dursleys are tormenting Harry, but they're only able to do that because Harry's hands are tied. He's not allowed to use any magic. But if you take away that prohibition, as they did in a couple of books, then his power is so disproportionate that he could do absolutely anything he wanted to them.
Right, and I get the idea that a machine gun and a thing of holy water wouldn't do anything to Voldemort.
I agree.
So that's, you know, I guess you would definitely have to limit the kinds of characters you can play and just say, look, in this game, you are meant to play something in particular and you just can't play something. It's like in Battletech. In Battletech, you could play, and we have run games where people are not mech warriors. But let's be honest,
what's the point?
The game was designed for you to play a mech warrior. Everything about the game is fine-tuned for you to be a guy in a gigantic walking robot. And I don't see really the Harry Potters being a whole lot different that you would have to play.
Well, I think it could work, but they would have to limit the scope of the game where your magically inclined characters were dominantly interacting only with other magically inclined characters. Therefore, your characters and the NPCs that you're interacting with are relatively equal in power.
I only see one big real world issue that they would have trouble representing in the game because it was just glossed over in at least the movies, which is liability insurance. Hogwarts is the most irresponsible institution on the face of the earth. They have woods infested by giant spiders and trees that kill people, and they have tournaments where they try to murder you.
Yeah, but they've only had two deaths in, 100 years?
But see, they get around that because in the second to the last chapter of every book, there's Madame Pomfrey, the magical nurse who has magical healing powers, and she can just, apparently, you know, she's a level 60 cleric and can just lay hands on you and make it all better.
Yeah, see, and that's exactly what I'm saying is, you know, if you wrote that out, then suddenly liability insurance for Hogwarts becomes a really, really big question.
You know what? Another problem I would see with it is not so much from the rules or the mechanic side, but the story. We talked when we were doing the SOG design series about how you can have towns that are like the dagger town, and everybody in the town has a dagger, and the mayor is stabby McStab'em.
Right.
That is how magic is in the... They can never do anything like a normal human.
And unless you're like, nobody sends emails.
Yeah, they send owls.
Yeah. I remember watching
Weasley.
Even if you had an owl, why would you use it over email? Because an owl has flight time, where an email is...
Because they don't have electricity in their houses.
Virtually instantaneous.
Yeah. Well,
everything's magic.
I remember watching, I guess.
I'm just saying, I would, if I had access to both an owl and an email, I would generally prefer email.
Well, but they make it pretty clear in the setting that the people who are raised in wizard houses, they don't really get the muggle technology. You know?
The thing is that the wizards are so far removed from the muggles. Why even bother having the muggles in the story?
But see, that's the same problem like the Jetsons and the old 60s Star Trek ran into, is that of course, in that case, it was fancy futuristic technology, that real world technology began to catch up to or even surpass these fantasy worlds. And so I think that perhaps the Harry Potter universe gets around that with that device where wizards just don't deal with muggle stuff. But the fact that through technology, muggles can fly and they can communicate over vast distances and they can wield a massive amounts of firepower and they can heal severe wounds.
That's kind of one of the things that I was thinking, is that if I was a first year student in a wizard duel, there are no problems here a 357 would not fix. I also remember, I guess when I was watching the first or second movie and the owls come flying in and they drop a broom in front of Harry. And I leaned to the person next to me. I said, well, I guess this is why their school sport isn't bowling.
That was one of the two deaths.
Yeah. That's when they switched to Quidditch.
I just got a weird image of the GM approaching his players. Goes, guys, I got a game. You guys are going to play normal everyday family. You go to work. You have fun. You've got this cousin who is weird. Just cast spells and find out he's going to go to a wizard school. Your job is to break him before he can go. That's how you do the muggle side of things. You play the Dursleys.
Perfect.
Your job is to drive him to suicide before his term starts.
He's half emo now. Go.
Have you seen those emo and goth pictures of Harry and Hermione?
Yeah, I have.
Those are funny.
I've seen some other, well, I won't get into those. But
get off your slash forums, anyways, man.
So next time, we actually didn't get to it this time because some of our other topics went a little longer than we thought. But to give you guys the teaser for, actually, I guess the next episode
will be
our Archon special.
Archon.
Local St. Louis convention, where we will be doing a follow-up episode. Melina will be joining us, and hopefully we will have something from the R-rated furry sex panel. And I did not add that word in there. That's the title of it, is a furry sex panel.
If they don't provide me with something, I will generate something.
We will generate something.
Because at that point, I will be loaded.
Now, the episode after that, Tex will be joining us again. And we are going to talk about how to add RP, or approaches for adding role-playing, to games that were intended to be war games. And we have had years of dorking around with this. And we actually wanted to talk about it today, but just we got tangented off on too many things, so we're kind of out of time here. So that's what we will be covering in two episodes. And, of course, three episodes from now, I believe, if I'm following my calendar right, will be our Gen Con episode, which we've got a couple different ideas on how we're going to approach that. So
I'm glad you do.
Over the next month, you're going to get two con episodes and some regular episodes. And we've got some other stuff that we're cooking up, contests and some non-contests, just new ideas for Fear the Boot that we're going to be try to be rolling out.
Oh, and not new.
We'll just see how these things work out. So, all right. Thank you guys for tuning in, and thank you all hosts for joining me. And we will catch you guys next time.
Later.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.